the British Country House Revival. Hello, I'm Richard Harwood. I'm a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
And I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Council at Wedlake Bell.
And I'm delighted to say that we're joined this morning by Ben Cowell, OBE, who is Director General of Historic Houses. So welcome, Ben. And instead of me trying to do an introduction to the work of historic houses, who better than the Director General to tell us about the work of HH for this episode about the challenges and solutions in the heritage sector?
Well, thank you, Clarissa, and thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. And I will talk a bit about historic houses, my day job, because that's pertinent to the topic of the book, The British Country House Revival. We at Historic Houses, we are effectively the business association that represents the independently owned bits of some of our most important heritage in the UK. In other words, big country houses, stately homes, whatever you want to call them, but large houses with collections, with lots of land often. And there are a great deal of these. In fact, we represent something like 1,400 properties across the UK. So that's a great deal more than the country house heritage that is owned and looked after so magnificently by the likes of the National Trust, which has around 200 big houses. We have 1,400. And that's really the sort of weighting that I'm leading to in the book, which is that most of this stuff remains in private, independent ownership. And that's how it's looked after.
Fantastic. And could you tell us a bit about the origins of HH and why the organisation was so needed?
The beginnings of historic houses, I mean, you can trace it back, and I try and do this in the book. It has a prehistory back to the 1930s when the National Trust was conceiving its own country houses scheme. And at the time, there wasn't even an idea that the National Trust would become the national representative, even for the private owners, as well as its own houses. It had one or two back then in the late 1930s. And then after the war, when many of these properties, during the war, they had been requisitioned and had suffered all sorts of decay and damage as a consequence. After the war, some of them started to open up to public visiting in quite a big way, in quite a commercial way. And once again, it became an idea that there ought to be some sort of representative body for the stately home owners of the country. And it took a while for this to really gather momentum. It did finally in the mid-1960s, when at that time, something called the British Travel Association sets up its own country houses committee behind the scenes, and they are doing all the things that these associations would do, so applying pressure on government to lobby for various improvements in the way planning or the tax system works. And what happens is that the BTA, the British Travel Association, becomes a government body in 1969 with the Tourism Act. It becomes the British Tourism Authority. So the same initials, different title. And it's no longer possible for these owners really to have properly independent representation by virtue of being a subcommittee of a government agency. So in 1973, they go completely independent and the Historic Houses Association is formed with Lord Montague at the helm.
So wonderful. And the British Country House Revival, which is the title of your book, the theme is about the survival of country houses. And in your book, you describe how houses have diversified and their economic recovery. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yes, I mean, that's very much the pivot of the book, if you like. The first half is called Survival, and the second half is called Revival, because it's that fall and rise of the country house story that I'm trying to tell for the last 50 years. Back in the early 1970s, there were still lots of problems that had been, as I mentioned, acquired during the war and in the years immediately afterwards. There was lots of repair work that still needed to be done. Lots of houses were in a bad way, lots of places that were suffering from rot and decay of different sorts. And this was a real heritage issue. It came to a head in those years of the early 1970s, at the time when the V&A was planning a big exhibition in October 1974, called The Destruction of the Country House. And Roy Strong, who was the new director there, had spotted just how many houses had been eradicated from the British landscape over the period of the previous century or so, beginning with the agricultural depression of the late 19th century and going all the way through the 20th century. So many had been lost. It was more than 1,000 houses that exhibition documented. And that trajectory was not softening at all. Houses continued to be lost and under threat. The very first publication that we at the HHA ever produced was a report by John Cornforth, the esteemed architectural editor of Country Life, called British Country Houses, Can They Survive? And his answer was in the negative. He didn't think any of them will be left 50 years later. In fact, he predicted there'd be fewer than 100 left as we speak today because so many were under threat. He thought, he anticipated they would be sold off, turned into hotels or golf courses or hospitals or whatever else, and the families would have no choice but to sell them off. So that was the situation as it was back then in the early 70s.
And in one of your earlier books, The Heritage Obsession, you say that a sense of the value of heritage often emerges as the result of a perception of imminent threat. And the V&A exhibition, before my time, I think before all of our times, both was the trigger for the establishment of, say, Britain's Heritage as a interest group promoting that, but also as a trigger for the reversal of the institutionalization and destruction of country houses. How did that come about? How was it turned from survival to revival?
Well, it's a really pertinent point. And you're right that heritage often is defined in relation to a threat, perceived or otherwise. It's often a threat that galvanizes support. And really, I suppose you could say that lots of what we regard today as the heritage sector or lobby group, as it were, dates from back then, from back in the early 1970s. As you say, groups like Save Britain's Heritage, Marcus Binney's outfit. And Marcus Binney was very active in working with people like Kit Martin, great architects who were finding new ways of making houses live and breathe in the late 20th century, because the demands of them as single residences for individuals or families were so great that actually Kit Martin found that one solution for houses was that they are split up into apartments and sold off individually. So that is one route that can be gone down. I think the V&A exhibition was so, if you like, totemic. It was raising this as a big political issue. And there was definitely politics behind it, because this was a time when Mr. Wilson's government of 1974, in fact, the exhibition opened 2 days before the election, the second election of that year, when the Labour manifesto was proposing a new form of wealth tax, not just a capital transfer tax, which they introduced, but an additional tax on top for those with the largest accumulations of wealth and assets. And this was a visible threat to country house owners. And it galvanized this campaign, which, if you like, reset the tax framework. There was this huge petition, more than 1 million signatures, delivered to Dennis Healey in late 1975. And actually, for various reasons, but not least, I think, the pressure that Healey was under, the wealth tax idea was shelved. And in fact, the capital tax arrangements for these places got a whole deal better. Dennis Healey introduced this method that had first been recommended by Ernest Gowers in his seminal report of 1950, which was this ability for owners of these places to exempt their property, as well as their chattels, their artworks, against capital tax. And that's the system we still have today. And I think that saved about 300 houses. Literally, it stopped them having to be sold off and becoming institutions or overly commercial uses. They remain family homes with their art collections intact, their landscape intact. And ultimately, that is it is a heritage issue. There is a heritage within that ensemble of the house, the family collection, and the landscape that particular bit of the tax code seeks to preserve. And I think that's an important heritage consideration.
I think it's always all about tax. And it is a theme, of course, that runs through your book about the revival of country houses. I think it's quite interesting to go back to something you said about the importance of houses being used as family homes. What is the value of that? Because after all, the houses might be saved if they did become hotels and golf courses.
Well, that's right. And we don't necessarily stop a country house hotel joining historic houses at the present day. There's nothing particularly wrong with that. But this was an issue that was discussed by Ernest Gowers and his committee in their report, because it was a phenomenon then, just after the Second World War, this notion that houses could be adapted for other uses, whether that's commercial or it's schools or hospitals or care homes or whatever else. And there's nothing wrong with that. As you say, it preserves the fabric of the building. But I suppose what I'm talking about is this sort of vague concept of the heritage that comes from the family who sometimes had built the house, continuing to live there and continuing to hold their collection there. Because often when owners are under threat, they have to sell bits of their collection to meet big repair bills or tax demands. And there is something about the major point that Gowers was making was that it is ultimately in the interests of the British taxpayer that families continue to live in their houses, that they don't become supplicants to state support. It's actually much more efficient for these places to remain as lived in family homes. Anyone knows the house you live in is the one you look after and care for the most. You have to, you live there. And so that's equally the same for these big country houses. The idea that they could fall upon the state to be rescued was something that Gowers rather dismissed. He said it's much better for them to remain as lived in houses. And I suppose that's the basis of it, I think.
It's fascinating because not only is there, as you say so eloquently in your book, there's a sort of magic in the heritage of having the family continue to live in their family home. It does definitely bring something to our heritage when we walk around these houses, you know, to know that they are still enjoyed by the families that built them. But also, if you want to be cynical about it, of course, as you say, it is entirely sensible, no doubt, for the owners of the homes to be the ones to look after them and frankly, pay for it. So I can completely see, since you put it that way, the policy of our national heritage being that it is well looked after in private hands.
I don't think that means that people have the right to live in their houses forever. I mean, no one has the God-given right. And of course, the history of these houses is one of occasional sales, sometimes fairly frequently. You know, families may sell their houses or buy other houses, and that happens all of the time. But there is this sort of ineffable sense of heritage value in the connection between a family and a house, as we know from countless National Trust places that tend to present the house from the perspective of the family that lived there. So that is a known heritage quantity that this is all about.
And I suppose in that context, families continuing to live in their homes and look after them, obviously your book sets out the enormous challenges which listed and heritage properties pose. What would you say are the main challenges for bringing historic homes up to modern standards for modern living and sustainability?
These houses have all shared the same common problem, which is that they are hugely expensive to maintain, without question. So in today's money, you know, you need, before you've even got out of bed, you need to know you can guarantee an annualized income of £100,000, £200,000, possibly more. You need that sort of revenue just to keep on top of the regular day-to-day repairs and then the cyclical repairs, the repairing the windows, the roof, and so on, just to keep these buildings watertight and therefore free from decay and dereliction. So that's the fundamental issue that all of these houses face, which is why tax becomes such an existential problem. It limits the freedom to apply your income to the care of the house. But obviously, places also live within a whole raft of different practical issues and problems that constrain the operation of these houses. They have to live within a planning framework that is quite restrictive, highly restrictive for listed buildings, for good reasons, of course. But it means you can't necessarily freely adapt the property in the ways that you might like to. You can't simply put in double glazed units in your grade 2-star or grade 1 listed house to reduce your energy bill, however much you'd like to make the place more comfortable for your family to live in. You have to apply for listed building consent, and more often than not, that might not be as easy to get if you are a grade 1 property. But there are all sorts of ways that we like to promote at historic houses for making places more energy efficient that stop short of those sorts of dramatic changes sometimes. But nonetheless, there's a whole raft of regulations, commercial requirements that come with, say, you're opening your house to the public, the health and safety requirements, the licensing regime if you want to serve alcohol or play music or run events. All of these things are constraints, but that hasn't held back the owners that I represent at historic houses, who by and large have been a very entrepreneurial group. That's what the last 50 years have seen, this flourishing of enterprise. Once the tax framework had been sorted out and you got economic revival into the 1980s with Mrs. Thatcher and the economic changes of that time, you had these places that were exploring all sorts of commercial avenues, becoming exciting places to visit, places that sometimes did quite exciting and dramatic things. Knebworth House in Hertfordshire launched its first rock concert 50 years ago this year. And they've been doing big music events like that ever since. And that was their route to finding a way to survive. Every house has a different path, and every house finds its own diverse way to succeed and survive into the 21st century.
Because they're businesses as well as homes.
They often are. I mean, some of our houses are purely private homes, but I would say that was the minority. The majority are businesses. And one of the biggest businesses that has emerged in the last 50 years has been the wedding business. Again, this was very much an area constrained by legislation, but the Marriage Act of 1994 liberalized the system to the extent that civil marriages could then take place in places that were not civic buildings, that you could be licensed to host a wedding ceremony. And certainly country houses have always been good places to have wedding parties afterwards. But now houses could do both. They could offer the wedding in the grand state rooms of the house and then the banquet afterwards in marquees on the lawn or wherever it might be. And about a third of our houses still do weddings. It's big business. In some ways, the country house has been saved by weddings in the last 50 years because of that change in legislation.
So there's a point in your book where you're talking about the planning requirements on owners of country houses, where you say that actually the level of requirements is so great that there may come a time when it's no longer viable to own a listed building. And I was wondering, really, in light of all of the things that people are able to do to meet the requirements, would you say, in fact, that the outlook is good? Would you say that there's a resilience to our country houses, that I want to hear that they'll be with us forever, Ben?
Well, I'd love to promise that as well. And I would say that this is a very resilient group of heritage custodians. They have weathered all sorts of storms, not least most recently the COVID pandemic that everyone suffered, of course. But if you have to close your house entirely to the public and you've lost that income stream, that was a major issue. But they've survived that, and they've survived other storms as well, sometimes literal storms, because we're seeing an increase, an uptick in those major weather events that can be very disruptive in countryside locations. But I would say I'm also an optimist and would say that these places will survive. What we are, I think, sometimes seeing is a slight increase in the number of houses that are coming to market. And I think perhaps that is perceptible at the present time, because there are constraints of living in these places. It's not at all easy. And I would say the climate change pressures, this pressure to make buildings energy efficient, is one of those things that makes it even harder to live in a house. If you have to live in a house where your EPC, your energy performance certificate, is all important and determines whether or not, for example, you can lease property if you don't meet the sufficient energy efficiency ratings. But then if you're not allowed to make those energy efficiency improvements, whether it's putting in secondary or double glazing or adding in solar panels in the walled garden or air source heat pumps around the back of the property, whatever it might be that you want to use to improve the efficiency of your property, I mean, that might make people think again about whether it's worth living in these places at all. Maybe they should just become offices or some other use rather than domestic houses. But I don't think that's going to happen, because I think, again, the resilience of many country house owners today is such that they're finding ways of working with their local planning office, working with Historic England, which is a great advocate and supporter and champion of the adaptation of these places, working with them to find solutions. So we find at places like Athelhampton in Dorset, which is a Grade One listed, very important Tudor manor house. They've put in sufficient number of solar panels and air source heat pumps to make the whole place a net zero country house. And that has to be the direction of travel. I think there does need to be some relaxation of the planning rules in this particular area. And there have been signs that there may be some of that on the cards in order for them to be sustainable going forwards. So that, I think, needs to happen. But in the meantime, owners are just getting on with it and finding ways of living in and adapting these properties to modern day situations.
Ben, in terms of the planning regime, is it, in your view, getting easier to use or harder to use, or is it becoming too restrictive at the local level?
It's certainly not, I would say, easier to use these days. And that's what our surveys tell us, because when we asked our members about their experiences of using the planning system, the vast majority, nearly 90%, tell us the planning system is an active deterrent to putting in energy efficiency measures. The planning statistics will show you that the majority of listed building consent applications are passed. But what that doesn't show you is how many initial conversations have been had with the local planning office about a proposal or a scheme, and they've had such a rebuff at the start, they've never bothered applying. So we don't get to see the full picture just from the bare statistics of listed building consent applications. And planning is just such a complicated area. It is getting more and more complicated as the years go by, as anyone who works in this field knows. And the compliance with different aspects of the planning system are such that it is always a challenge to work with that system. But I think, again, it can be that some changes to the system can make life a deal easier for looking after this heritage. After all, this system of protection for heritage that we've had in the planning system, I suppose, since 1947, when listed buildings first became a feature of the law. We'd had some protections before then for ancient monuments since the late Victorian period, but listing only came in 1947. And I think it was, at the time, intended to stop buildings being demolished, because there were so many buildings that were being taken down. Owners were doing it of their own volition. They were deciding that it made more financial sense to take the building down brick by brick and to sell it for its building materials. And the listed building system was put in to stop that sort of thing from happening. And I think that's important. I support that entirely. I think it was not put in to preserve everything in aspic, as the cliche goes, to stop any sort of evolution of these houses. These places only have a history because they have changed and adapted. And so many country houses that you might visit are, you know, the second or third country house on the same site, because previous owners have taken down the house and rebuilt it entirely in some new fashion or some new architectural style. And once you're listed and protected by the listing system, more or less that history stops. And whenever you want to make a change, you have to apply for listed building consent. I'm perfectly happy with that, but I think there does need to be, in my view, a bit more of a relaxed attitude towards making changes that are quite sensible and allow these buildings to continue to evolve as historic entities.
I think it's that sense that the regime changed. As you say, it was initially listing was about preventing demolition or very major works, and then 1968 Act, I think, in particular, broaden the control to anything that affects the special interest. But there's been the recognition, Planning Practice Guidance 15 in the 1994 amounts, emphasised that, generally speaking, listed buildings are buildings which are remaining in use, very distinct from scheduled monuments, which usually aren't remaining in use, that need to evolve and that need to sort of maintain their active use and the occupation by the people who are living and working there. Now, that particular point hasn't made it through into the current policy guidance. I mean, you sort of hope it's implicit, but is there a sense that sometimes people slightly lose track of the fact that actually these are meant to be living, working, occupied buildings?
I think you're absolutely right there, Richard. And I think that is ultimately the only way this heritage is sustainable and has a long-term future. And that is what we're talking about here, the long-term protection and preservation of this heritage. That's what the law were set up to ensure. But if the conditions are such that they can no longer be lived in, the law is sort of acting against itself then. And this is where some more liberal regime, perhaps, when it comes to changes in country houses, would be advantageous to enable the long-term future of these places. I think this is where it also ties in with the tax framework that we were talking about earlier, because there is this Bible for HMRC, this document called Capital Taxation and the National Heritage. And in the first paragraph, it states that it remains government policy that these places should be, by and large, occupied privately. It's not in the state's interest to own all of the heritage by any means. In fact, the government is clearly saying we might own some of it, a few bits of it, and some of it will be looked after by major charities like the National Trust, but the majority of it will be occupied privately. And by implication, they are lived in places. They are places that are inhabited, occupied, and that provide an ongoing sustenance for a family or a group of people that might live there. And that is implicit, I think, in the tax framework as well as in the planning framework.
So is there anything of the tax incentives that work together to preserve our historic homes? You've suggested that with planning consent, it would be helpful to have some measure of flexibility. Is there anything, if you could wave a magic wand, is there anything that you would change in tax policy to do with perhaps the conditional exemption from tax for heritage, art and property, or any of the other tax incentive schemes that are there to protect the country homes?
I would say this framework is pretty good, actually. And I think it's noticeable that it doesn't get talked about as much as perhaps it needs to be, because this is seen as a slightly esoteric niche area of government altogether. But certainly when it comes to tax, it's a fairly specialist area, one might assume. But I think it has led to the protection of 300 or so houses and many more works of art that have been able to have been exempted back since when exemption was first introduced, which was in 1896, I think, when the first death duties came in. And this was a measure designed to stop works of art being sold off from this country. At that time, lots of artwork was finding its way to galleries in other European countries or to houses in other European countries, or indeed to America and going to the big galleries there. And that whole system of exemption and then the parallel systems of acceptance in lieu and all of these other measures that is designed to keep artworks really in this country, ideally on show to the public, not always perhaps, but obviously exemption carries with it the requirement of being open to the public nowadays. And I think that system works well. I think if I had a magic wand, I would want to give more resources perhaps to that the bit of HMRC that is looking after this system. It feels sometimes like it's been slightly forgotten. And anyone applying today for a conditional exemption for their buildings or their landscape or their artworks finds they have quite a long delay because there are so many bits of government that need to be involved. There's the involvement of, in some cases, the Arts Council, English Heritage, Historic England, Natural England, and they're all great organizations with keen groups of people. But coordinating all of that just inevitably ends up taking lots of time. And that whole bit could be allowed to work more smoothly, but that's an impossible ask because there's never enough money in government. So I appreciate that. But simply keeping the system intact and not allowing it to be changed, I think would be a great thing because I think it's done wonders for the nation's heritage in the last 50 or more years.
There's a bit in your book, which is something that I often reflect on, which is that the beauty of our country homes is that when we walk around them, we do have access to seeing the furniture and the works of art, which tell the stories of how the homes have been lived in. And that's something I think is particularly characteristic of our country. And it's not the case in all countries. And I really think that I completely agree with you about the conditional exemption regime and how that's really enabled us to have that heritage with us still. And hopefully the resilience of our country houses will be such that we will be enjoying it forever.
I think you're right. It's a very special thing we've got in this country. Often there's the comparison is drawn with France, say, with its empty chateau, or the Eastern European countries with their amazing buildings that were occupied after the war by the state and didn't necessarily have such a wonderful time and were battered and bruised as a consequence. And yet we have in this country clearly houses that have weathered all sorts of storms and dramas in our own political history in Britain. But we do have this tradition of these lived-in family homes and these remarkable places where the same family has lived sometimes for 800 years or more. I mean, I'm thinking of places like Powderham Castle in Devon or Stoner in Oxfordshire. And it's been a real struggle at times for those families to hold on to that house and the collection inside it. There's so much history that emerges from that. There's so much of interest to the visiting public. It's a story people love to hear about. But I think the tax framework does enable that to be the case in this country. It's definitely something that we should be proud of as a nation.
Well, I suppose then a last question. Your book, The British Country House Revival, opens speaking about the 1974 exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum. Is it time for another exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum or elsewhere? And what should we call it?
Oh, gosh, that's a really good question. I think we had that destruction exhibition in 1974. And then 10 or 11 years later, there was the Great Treasure Houses of Britain exhibition that was in Washington, D.C. All of these houses contributed works of art that were then on show in America in this grand exhibition, which in effect symbolized that transformation from a decade earlier. They'd gone from the point of destruction to the point of celebration of this wonderful heritage. And there have been exhibitions since then, and there continue to be great exhibitions across historic houses properties. I suppose it's a unique thing to go and see artworks in situ, in the places where they often were bought for. These places were often bought on spec for the walls of particular houses. And so it's wonderful to see it in that context, as well as in an exhibition space. Obviously, lots of our members are also loaning items to big exhibitions put on these days by the Tate or by the National Gallery. So that tradition continues. Whether or not we could have an exhibition on the scale of the Treasure Houses of Britain, I don't know. It's a lovely thought. These things are quite expensive to run, of course. So I think that the artworks are quite happy where they are. And for millions of people to go and visit them every year, knowing they can go to Chatsworth or to Blenheim and see fantastic artworks on the wall there, that's quite a special thing that we've got in this country.
Well, I suggest we somehow organise a new exhibition celebrating the resilience of our country houses and call it the same title as your book, Ben, The British Country House Revival, which I could not recommend more highly. And thank you so much for joining us today. I've so enjoyed our conversation.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.